Come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together, we get better. In person, January 12th through 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, weekend-long big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups for LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, plus a boutique where you can shop till you drop. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night? Book your room now at a discounted rate through the oabirthday.com website, and act fast because rooms sell out quickly. There is a solution. You'll hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together, we get better.
Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Christian. I'm a compulsive overeater, anorexic, bulimic. And numbers. I have been in program for 20 years. I am 19 years abstinent, and I have 279-pound weight loss from my top weight. And I work the steps. I meditate in the morning. I do all this craziness. But if we go back to the beginning, when I first came down to LA, or actually when I went to the very first meeting in OA that I ever went to, it was in a little city, Danville, California, up in Northern California. And I had my entire, at least 80% of my kitchen, all the cabinets were filled with canned food or packaged food or something. You'd think I was a survivalist and waiting for the next, knowing something was coming that no one else did. I I was very angry, very unhappy, and just put on, I don't even know if I put on airs to be anything other than miserable and mean. I don't remember putting energy into pretending to be happy or nice. I was very, very, very alone. I come from a fairly miserable childhood. Not materially, I was a privileged child. My parents were successful. I was an only child. But there was extreme sexual and physical abuse taking place. So all the things made it look like I had this fabulous childhood and life. But, you know, things don't make you a sane person. Things don't drive you to find some escape in the form of any number of drugs of choice. And I chose food. My dad was an alcoholic, so I would never emulate him nor do anything like him. That's what I thought back then. So I said, I'm not going to drink. So the one thing I had access to was food. But even then, I had to sneak it past him while he was in his drunken blackout. Because mysteriously enough, no matter how much he drank, if I was trying to sneak by him into my bedroom and he's like blacked out in a chair, he'd wake up. Like, I don't know how he did it, but he'd always wake up. And I'd always, so I had to learn to hide food on my body. And I'd have, you know, cheese in my nether regions. I'd have cookies in my pockets. I'd have, you name it, wherever I could hide it, I hid it. And so I could get it past him because I needed that drug. He was my abuser. He was my sexual abuser. He's my physical abuser. He's my emotional abuser. And he really did a bang up job conditioning me for being just that and subservient and people pleasing and all these other wonderful traits that I had to learn to survive. So it looked like a great childhood. And I also learned to be a great liar because he was relentless if I let anyone know that there could be anything wrong in our household. He was very much so, you know, anything that's going on at home stays at home. Everything else is, you know, the public sees our smiles and our going to church and all this ridiculousness, and that just was meaningless. It's, in the end, it's meaningless. And I got to see him to the very end, and trust me, it's meaningless. So at least that's my perception, obviously. But from what I saw, it didn't change anything in the end. I did end up taking care of both my parents. Happily took care of my mom, of course. And all these years later, I was adopted, which is why I was an only child. And I found out I wasn't adopted. I was purchased. There were no adoption records. There are nothing official about me. I've learned, I found my birth mother, and I have four half-sisters. And I've been in touch with one of them, and I've learned so much. I'm still processing it, so I can't really share all of it yet. It's still percolating and processing, and thank God I work with an outside source, my therapist, to get through it. But I had interesting start to my life, and I didn't even have anything to do with it. But needless to say, I was not a happy person. I got a job. I went to college as soon as I was 18. Got into college and moved out. I ran away from home as quick as I could, and went to school. Did really mediocre in my undergraduate years. In fact, it's kind of embarrassing to look back. Oh, how did I do so bad? I'm actually pretty good at school, and so a bit, just barely got my bachelor's degree in communications, which is what they always is what everyone says you get when you're not a math or science person, but. I continued to overeat, and it actually accelerated when I got into college. College, I gained hundreds of pounds, easily 200 pounds or more. My top weight is 535 pounds weighed. I wouldn't get on a scale after that because I didn't want to know anymore. And I don't think my doctors wanted to know. They did, but they kind of didn't. So I was pretty unhappy. And I was also, I'm a gay man. And I wasn't out of the closet. I was in a fraternity because I thought that would make me more male, more manly. It doesn't. And I did all these things. I played all these sports because I thought it's going to make me masculine because that's what my dad did to me. When I was growing up, I had to play every sport, whether I was good or bad at it and whether I wanted to or not, because that made me masculine in his eyes. He was very stuck on being macho and machismo and all that. Well, garbage to me. So I grew up with that, and I was good at most sports. I'm actually pretty good at. So I was athletic. So I wasn't embarrassing him or anything. God forbid. I can't imagine what more he'd do to me. But I'm glad I didn't find out. My heart wasn't behind it. And in college, went nuts. You know, people say what freshman 40 or something. I wasn't a freshman. I was actually a sophomore, but I did, you know, sophomore 700. I don't know, some huge amount. And I used up my, I forget what they call it, but the card you get for food, I used that up. It was supposed to last a month. I used it like, I think in a week and a half, 2 weeks, and I had to start paying out of pocket for stuff. So I got a part-time job, and then I found this one place that made a gigantic, like, 5 foot wide or 3 foot wide pizza. It was obscene. And I'd get that and that would be a meal. And it sounds like a lot, but I ate a lot. And luckily at that time, I hadn't discovered my bulimic or anorexic side. So it was just nonstop eating and feeling horrible, blacking out. So that was the past. And I was not happy. I graduated from college, went out into the world of work, got great jobs, earned good money, but I was miserable. I did a bunch of travel in my early 20s, and I lived abroad. I lived in Germany for 7 years and worked there, and it was incredible. But it's amazing when I look back at it, it was very one-sided. It was very, like, I had to go back many years later to see Germany. Because I didn't really go, I ate my way through Germany. I ate my way through Paris. I ate my way through all these cities and places I went. But I didn't really go to see anything. You know, I remember I went to the Eiffel Tower because there's a restaurant at the bottom. Not because it's the Eiffel freaking Tower, but because it had a restaurant. So I knew I could get food. I could go up, come down and eat. That was my motivation. Like, I'm in these beautiful places And all I could think about was where's the next cafe? Where can I get my next sandwich or food? What a waste. It seems like such a grotesque waste of this beautiful place I got to be for next to nothing. And I was earning an obscene amount of money back then. This was before the euro. So I was earning like, it was like two Deutsche marks to the dollar. Everywhere I went, it was, the dollar was much stronger back then. So I really like literally ate my way through Europe. And wasted just didn't waste. It was whatever's happened was God's will in the end. Even though I didn't believe in God, God was my enemy. I hated the church. I hated all forms of religion, and anyone who participated in religion were a bunch of a-holes too. And I hated them too. And the word hate and dislike and discomfort were very common terms for me in my past. And that's just how I was. I wasn't even comfortable in my own body. And I remember one man. I was wearing a backpack. And I was going to the English Gardens. They call them the English Gardens in Munich, Germany. I had my backpack on, and I guess it was framing my breasts. And I didn't know I had breasts back then. Like I didn't face that reality that when you're 5 or plus pounds, you got tits. I'm sorry, breasts. And this man walked up to me and said in German, "You have a really nice," basically he said "nice rack." But in German it translates even worse, like you have gross breasts or something like that. And I asked a friend of mine, what did he say to me? And he goes, he said, "You have really nice tits." And I'm, oh, and I died because my body dysmorphia, I didn't look below my neckline. So I didn't think I looked like that. I didn't think I was so heavy that I had these beautiful breasts for men to look at. And fortunately, being a gay man, it didn't affect me all that much. But in not meaning that, but meaning, if I was maybe not the gay man, it would have bugged me a lot more and would have been much more tragic. But I just remembered saying that, and that's when I realized, wow, I don't look like any of these people, even though in my head I do. But I don't look like these people. And the people in Europe in general are just used to be not as big as Americans. And I was your very stereotypical American, a really big, heavy guy walking around, being American. Nothing wrong with that, but it is everywhere else. But so my experience in living abroad was terrific, but it was also very limited because it was always about food and meals and where's the next thing coming. So I came to program here in LA. And the first meeting in Danville was with three housewives who were all on the verge of divorcing their husbands. And that was it. And I was the fourth person and I totally didn't fit in. And I said, this isn't for me. And I went home and I binged and stopped at all the drive-throughs on the way home. When I got here, I went to a meeting in West Hollywood thinking I was going to be surrounded by gay men and beautiful people and we're all going to be beautiful together and just yay. I went to a women's meeting. A women's only meeting. They were gracious enough to let me come in and sit with them for the whole time and disrupt their female energy in that room. And at the end, they very gently said, you can't come back to this meeting. But they were really nice. It was a big book study meeting and it was at the log cabin. Luckily, I still had, after all that humiliation, even though it had nothing to do with them, I was just putting the humiliation on myself. I went and found another meeting, and it was a 100-pounders meeting on Thursdays at the Methodist Church in Westchester. And I went to that meeting, and there was a man leading that meeting that told my story, seemed a lot like me. We looked very different, but who was his experience similar to mine? I mean, he got up there and told my story, and I'll never forget, like, I'm sweating like a farm animal or an animal at a slaughterhouse. I'm just sweating through my clothes. And at the end of that meeting, I went and asked that man to be my sponsor 19 years ago. And well, blessedly, he's in this room and he has been my sponsor the whole time. And we have come a long ways. And I feel like that Virginia Slims commercial, we've come a long ways, girl. But of course, that's not a term I use for him. That's a term towards me. But it has been an incredible ride. I went from being this miserable person with I had financial security, like the yin yang. But it's weird when you're miserable on that, in your disease, and you're just miserable. It doesn't matter. The things don't matter. You're not happier. You don't know. I didn't know how to be content or happy or grateful. I didn't do gratitude lists. Are you kidding? You know how much more I wanted? I should have had a Mercedes S-Class. I should have had all these things that I was defined as success and that I defined as me being a significant being on this planet. I thought when I got these high-level things, that was going to be it. That's when I could say I made it. And that's when I could say, I'm fine. I'm fine. And that was a big word for me, fine, which, means, well, I fearful, it's a fearful, insecure, narcissistic, and emotional. I'm fine. I felt like Sally Field in Steel Magnolias when she's like, I'm fine. I'm fine. It's just clenching your fists. That's how I was all the time. There was no joy. And now I can tell you, I am not financially comfortable as I used to be. I can't get all these things. I can't do all the things I want to do. But I have more joy, more happiness, more fulfillment in this stage of my life because of programming, because working the 12 steps, because coming to the meetings and participating in the meetings and being of service and being a sponsor. Oh, dear Lord, being a sponsor. It makes it possible for me to be more happier and more deeply fulfilled in my life now than I ever was. And
Excuse me,
with
that's
all,
5 minutes left, Christian. Thanks.
I appreciate it, Melissa. Thank you. And with all of that, I learned hope, love. I have love in my life now. I did not have back then. I have a commitment. I'm able to make commitments and fulfill them. I don't just snake out of them or have to put that energy in. There was one thing, I was applying for something, and a friend had said, "Oh, you could just, fudge this a little bit." I tried. I can't do it. I can't do it. I've been in program. I'm such a liar till I got into till about midway through my recovery and program. I couldn't do it. I don't have the energy for it, and I don't want to try and support anything that's not 100% accurate. It takes too much energy, and it goes against my recovery. And I wouldn't be who I am today if I reverted back to any of my old practices. So I get to live a life that's not carefree. It's not my dream life right now. It's not my nightmare life, which I was living. I get to t live life on life's terms, and I get to accept what I have, and know that if I keep taking actions, I don't have to worry about the results. They really are up to God. And that's a huge change for me. Now I'm not going to pretend like there aren't new things. Like instead of dealing with compulsive overeating and food, now I've been dealing with everything else that pushed me into that category of overeating and then undereating and then starving myself. I have, examining your life is what you end up in next. Like you don't call your sponsor anymore and talk about food. That's like such a thing of the past for me. It's now it's talking about just life and life's terms and how hard it is to accept life on life's terms. And my emotional development was stunted because of my compulsive overeating. So I think I'm only about maybe 8 or 9 years old as far as my emotional development. So it's really tough at times. I have a hard time still getting out of my own way and getting out of my own head, particularly in my relationship. I've been in an 11-year relationship now, and it's tough. It's really hard, and it's when Daniel doesn't behave. His name is Daniel. When he doesn't behave the way I want him to, or he doesn't react to something the way I think he should react, I find it very challenging to manage my emotions and deal with him and not lash out at him. And I realized that's just me. That's my emotional development. I'm still a little stunt. I am still, I will always be stunted. But thank God I have a sponsor to call. I have fellows to call. I have a therapist to text. I have a whole team, a whole cadre of people I can talk to about my lack of emotional development. When I become very, very narcissistic and I want to just say, well, I didn't do that to him when he needed something. Well, that's you. That was your choice. What he does is not under your control. And you can't judge him by your standards because your standards are obviously not his. And bottom line, I was looking at it, he's not compulsive overeater. He's not anorexic or a bulimic. So Who am I to judge what he's doing? He's obviously doing something, and something different than me, and it's working. So I have to learn to get out of my own way. That feels like the lesson I'm learning. I had to learn in 23. And for 24, I'm working on not being in my way. I'm working on meditating. I'm working on connecting to my higher power every morning. I always say, fill me with your love, light, and hope, because my spiritual void, I don't have any love, light. I don't have any love, light, and hope of my own. It has to come from my higher power. And that's why I'm able to share hope, is just because my higher power blesses me with it when I ask for it in the morning. And I say, please give it to me so I can share it with whoever may need it throughout the day. Or if I'm working with my students, whoever, you know, whatever students, please let me just share my love, light, and hope with my students, because whatever I'm doing for them, I'm being of service to them. It's not about me feeling good about what I'm doing. It's about them learning and being my best for them, and being my best for my partner, being my best for our friends and family of choice. So it's a really big deal. There are prices I'm paying for decisions in the past when I wasn't quite in my right mind. I made some really dumb choices, particularly on a financial level. But you know what? That's the wreckage of my own past, more recent past. And whatever is going on, I'll get through it. I know I can turn to my fellows. I can turn to my sponsor. I can turn to friends. Well, my friends and family of choice again. I mean, I have more blessings than I do deficits in my life today. And I'm choosing not to worry about everything. So thank you for letting me share. This is the time for questions only. There's no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you asked a question last week, please wait until the first three questions have been asked before raising your hand. If you have a question, please click the raise your hand icon. Yes, Bob.
Yes, thank you for an incredible share, Christian. Your connection with God or a higher power, where did that come from? How did it happen? And what's it like now? Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. My connection with, you know, I was raised, the ritual I was raised in was Catholic, Latin Catholic. And that didn't teach me one thing about spirituality. So I will resign and say, you know, working with my sponsor in the early days, I wanted to believe I was atheist, agnostic. And really, I still believed in God. So it was probably more agnostic than atheist. But I had to, you know, basically, I was told, well, you know, make something happen, basically. Do something. Do something. If you're a God, if you're your own Alpha and Omega, then I want to see a tree grow in your front yard, just appear, be fully matured. I want an apple, you know, apple tree, and it's full of apples. You know, that would be a godlike power. And, you know, I couldn't do it. I can't do it. I can't even make grass. I can't even keep a plant alive, let's be honest. And let alone have grass grow or make a tree appear. So that was that type of language and that type of example was what humbled me enough to go, I have to figure something out. Because whatever I've been doing, it got me into these rooms. Whatever I was doing got me to 535 pounds and it wasn't working. So basically I had to, you know, the world according to Christian wasn't working. And my sponsor, in a very kind way, made that clear and helped me to come to that conclusion. And I realized it could be a doorknob. My higher power could be anything I want it to be. And that was what really allowed me to get a spiritual base in this program, was knowing it could be anything. And it's evolved and changed over the years. But just knowing I'm not the Alpha or the Omega and that I'm not it was absolutely what I needed. And that's what I needed to be shown to me. Throw it in my face. Deb.
Thanks, Christian. That was awesome. Can you talk about how you discovered your abstinence and what that was like, you know, at the beginning and what it's like now? And I guess that made you giggle. So I like that.
Okay. In the beginning, I just wanted to be the rock star of LA. Like, That's so, now all these are all so stupid to me, but you know, oh, I wanted to be the rock star. So I wrote all this stuff, pages of stuff in my big book, my red light foods, my yellow light foods under, I'm not laughing because it doesn't work for people. I'm laughing because it did work for me. It profoundly didn't work for me. I had these huge lists and I couldn't, I am not a list person. I am not someone who would refer back to my big book to see what I could eat that day. I am just, I wasn't that disciplined. I don't even know if I am at all today still. But that was my first episode of saying I can't eat all these foods, and that didn't work. I'm one of those people, because of my upbringing, you tell me to do something, I kind of run the opposite direction. Like, you know, don't mow the lawn like this, so I'll mow it exactly like that. You know, don't walk, run, so I'll crawl. You know, I'm just not. And so writing that list basically was challenging myself to eat everything on that list. And I went to the Olympics, 2006 Olympics with friends. And this is what I mean about very different lifestyle back then. And I remember I thought I was abstinent, and I traded an alcoholic beverage for a food item, a dessert that I wasn't supposed to eat, which was on the red light list. And my friend lost his sobriety. I lost my abstinence. But I didn't have any abstinence at that point. That was my first year in program. And Tony, Anyway, my sponsor knew that. And all of the big, huge Serenity Sunday meeting from the old days in the old room knew it too. And I had to confess to them. But that is, that's where my first abstinence went. Then I was walking with a very dear friend of mine who's also in the room. And we were talking, and she kind of just said, you know, a very simple abstinence might work. It was a great guidance. And that's, you know, no refined sugar and no white flour. Really basic. And I didn't even realize that was like kind of hitting my, like hitting my big, the big things that I needed to be abstinent from. And from that point on, that was 19 years ago. So it just kind of evolved like that. I had to have the joke and the ridiculousness before I could appreciate the sanity of not having to think about what I could put in my mouth. Tony.
Good morning, Christian. Thank you so much for your share. You identify also as an anorexic bulimic. Can you talk a little bit about that journey through your recovery?
No. Absolutely. See, rebel, little jerk. Me, not him, me. Anyway, I took care of my partner through anal cancer and all his treatments. And unfortunately, no one told me to wear a mask when I was cleaning some unpleasant areas that needed to be cleaned regularly. And I ended up with an infection that affected the way my stomach cells reproduce. So I have a congenital stomach issue that was quite bad for quite a few years because they couldn't diagnose it. They couldn't figure out because it's a very rare condition that only 1% of people get. And of course, I fell on that 1%. And that is when my disease was in the room doing pull-ups or push-ups. And it said, hey, he can't eat a lot. So instead, let's have them eat nothing. Let's try nothing. Let's try. And also I was throwing up was part of the issue. And then all of a sudden it said, hey, instead of just letting them naturally do what's happening because of the stomach condition, how about we try this other times? How about when we go in the bathroom, we try to get sick. We try to coax our body into throwing up. So they literally, and the anorexia and the bulimia crept up on me like thieves in the night, or like ninjas. It was so subtle because it blended in with what was already going on in my body. But then my partner one day was like, after I was in the bathroom supposedly being sick from my illness, he goes, you know, it really sounded like someone, like he said it like this, it really sounds like someone was trying to throw up in the bathroom and not just throwing up. And he goes, you know, they sound different, right? And that's really how the bulimia crept in. And then I realized I wasn't eating, And I wasn't not eating because of my illness. I was choosing not to eat. It crept in there too. And I was choosing not to eat. So I was starving myself. And I did it for years. I was like about 3 years. I was starving myself. And that made me nauseous. So that would give me an excuse to go throw up. So all these weird, it's insane connections that took place. Ooh, if I starve myself, then I can go throw up. And then I feel better for a little bit. And then I could do this again. And it became a pattern. And when I was diagnosed and received medication that actually took care of the issues with the stomach condition, with the symptoms and what was happening, I was still doing the same thing. And that's when I realized, you're anorexic and bulimic now, because you've been willingly making yourself throw up, and you've been not eating purposefully so you could go throw up, even though you weren't really throwing up anything but bile. But yeah, that's how crazy and subtle those diseases snuck into my identity as a compulsive overeater. I never thought that I'd ever be able to say anorexia or bulimia were part of my life, but they are. They are, and I have to be conscious of it. Even though I have a condition that could cause me to do to be sick, it's a really different animal. It's easy to identify when I'm trying to be sick as opposed to just being ill. I hope that answered the question. Thank you. Bueller? Old reference. I think some people might know. Yes, Cheryl.
Hi, Christian. Thank you for your lead. You seem like a very inherently optimistic person, but based just on what you've had, childhood abuse, and you have this terrible disease that you didn't deserve, if you feel raged, can you tell me how do the steps help you deal with that rage? Thank you.
Oh, that is a good question. I feel rage. I generally in recovery have been blessed with, at this stage, being more happy and content than malcontent and unhappy or angry. But when I get angry, I go for the jugular. I have no second or third gear. It goes from first gear happy to fifth gear overdrive, insanely angry. Like if I get mad, I get mad. When I get mad, I'm mad. I go for the jugular. I hurt the people who made me mad. And then I end up having to make amends, which I hate doing. Hate making amends. Because that's admitting I was wrong. So when I get really angry, I do lash out. But the program and my recovery around that, which it takes a lot more to get me there than it used to. I just have to take a moment to breathe. I say a prayer. I usually say the third step prayer. And then I really look at my part in what's going on. Or I make a call to my sponsor and ask him, what's my part? What's going on? You know, I feel like I'm insane. And I am. And it's usually very clear. He usually makes it very clear to me what my part in it is. As soon as I see my part, that's when I start to really calm down. And I say, okay, all my lashing out and knee-jerk reactions, I don't do that as often anymore. But when I do, I have to make an immediate amends. I have to talk. Usually it's with Daniel. And I have to go make the amends immediately and say, I'm sorry for my part in this. I'm sorry that I did. I never apologize for the other person's part, though. Everyone has a part. When there's a fight or an incident, there's always two people. I will never take accountability for anyone else. That's another thing I had to learn. Because as a people pleaser, I used to just take on the whole thing. It's all my fault. It's me. It's me, me, me. And it isn't. Only part of it's me. And the part that I can control is me. And I barely control me. So I just have to be humble enough to say, I'm sorry I lost it. I apologize for my role in this. And I'm going to strive to be better. I'm going to make that sorry mean something. And that's my difference in program, is that sorry means something to me. When I say I'm sorry, it means I have to change that behavior. I don't get to do it over again. I don't get to keep doing it over and over again. I hope that helped. Melissa.
Hi, Christian. Thank you for your beautiful share. By the way, there's 5 minutes left for Q&A. Perfect time. Can you share with us kind of your journey of connection and relationship with your higher power?
Sure. My higher power, I need to connect to my higher power. It's not an innate thing that just happens for me. And there are times when I'm blessed that when I call a fellow or a sponsor or someone in program, they usually, I notice that the first thing they'll say is, where's God in that? Where's God? And that's a question I have to teach my, I've had to teach myself to ask when I'm feeling distressed or feeling anything that might be a little off. I always have to remind myself, where's God? And if not, I have to call a fellow and let them remind me, where's God in this? Where's your connection to your higher power? The meditation I do in the morning is my initial opening my heart and my soul to my higher power for the day. So I could say, you know what, I'm going to make choices. I'm going to take actions. And I'm going to leave the results up to you, because your will, God's will superseding my will, is the only way I get through a day without harming myself or others, and or through action, possibly harming someone else. So I've had to evolve that. I've had to learn to humble myself enough in the morning to wake up and go connect to God. Just do it now, because if you don't do it now, you're going to forget to do it later. And then your day will go in that weird direction you don't like, because you're trying, you're living your will and you haven't said, okay, God, let's do your will today. So it's just kind of slowly through just accepting my powerlessness over my life, not just food, not even food anymore, just over my life, and realizing that all the choices I made got me in here. So try something different, Christian. Carol?
Thank you for your share, Christian. You are a delight. Expectations, particularly when you have an expectation of a friend, where you've learned to temper your expectations, but then sometimes you end up getting hurt anyway. How do you let go of that? How do you accept people for who they are on life's terms?
I don't know if I do that yet. The greatest example would be my partner, Daniel. We are very different people. And, you know, of course, different balances each other, but also it drives me out of my freaking mind. Because I have to be able to say, whatever's going on, I can't assign me to it. Like, I can't compare anyone to what I would do or how I would act. Because how I would do and what I would act is insane. That's why I'm in here. I'm cuckoo bird. And I'm only speaking for myself. I'm cuckoo bird. I know that. I know I'm not sane. I was saying I would never have done what I did with food. I wouldn't do a lot of things that I abused myself with. So I just try to, I always try to look at it from the other perspective. Like, what, I know my part in it, but what, how did this begin? Where is the source of this? What's the source of my discomfort? What's the source of this? And like, where am I coming from? Is this like a button that my, you know, my abusive father installed at one point and it just got pushed? And that's why it escalated. Is this something from my past? Is this something that I just need? Is it one of my character defects that I just haven't gotten to yet? Because there's a lot. And I just have to, I do a lot of examination. Sometimes I have to write about it sometimes because I'm amazed what comes out in my writing. Because I feel like there's always a little connection. There's a connection with my higher power when I'm writing, and I don't like writing. Can't stand it. But sometimes that's what works too. It'll just get me out of my head. Sometimes God will bless me with a sponsee calling at the right moment that gets me out of Christian world and into sponsor and my sponsee world. And it always allows me to have that back up and have that better perspective. So I can figure out, what am I doing? What's my part? And how can this be, how can I not repeat this behavior again? Did that answer your question, Carol?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
18 seconds left.
And we're in the last 5 seconds, folks. No. Thank you very much. And thank you for letting me share.